afternoon. My name is Bob Cochran. I work here at Pepperdine and generally in charge of the conference, but I guess in particular am moderating this panel. And this panel is about a book project that I'm involved with. And I'll introduce our panelists in just a little bit, but they're each involved as well. David Van Drunen, down to my left, and I are co-editing a volume called The Bible and the Law, or at least that's our title at this point, and I think that's probably going to stick. And I'm going to start off just by introducing the project, telling you a little bit about it, and then I'll introduce our panelists who are going to address the sections of the book that they're working on. What we've done is that we've taken the Bible and then we've divided it up into sections, into nine different sections. And for each of those sections, we've identified a law professor and a theologian who together are writing a chapter that addresses how that section might address law. Now, when we say law, the focus of the book is on what's called the civil law or the positive law. It's the law that we as lawyers and we as law students deal with. It's governmental law, as contrasted maybe with the moral law or law more broadly speaking. But it's what we're trying to focus on is law as. As many of you would be interested in. You may be interested in how we've broken things down as far as sections go. We've got one section that deals with Genesis, creation, fall, and the patriarchs. A second section that deals with the Mosaic Law. The third with the history of Israel. Fourth with the wisdom literature. Five with the prophets, six, Jesus and the law, seven, the history of the early church, eight is the letters of the early church, and then finally one on eschatology or future things, prophecy in that sense. You've got a selection of folks that have done essays for the book. We don't have all nine sections represent it, but I think this will fill up our time and then give us some time for discussion. We'll work from my left to the right to my right, which is in biblical order. I guess that's a pretty good order since that's the way the people that organized the Bible did, or God Himself did, anyway. To my left, as I said, is David Van Drunen. He is both a theologian and a lawyer, and so he brings a wonderful mixed perspective. I'm just going to briefly identify people by their institutional affiliation. You've got in front of you the brochures that give fuller descriptions of them if you're interested in something fuller. David teaches at Westminster Seminary here in Southern California, and he did the essay with his partner on Genesis. Next to him is Tremper Longman. Tremper did the work on the Mosaic Law, and Tremper teaches at Westmont College. Barbara Armacost did her chapter on the prophets. And finally, Dallas Willard, who with me did an essay on Jesus and the law. I may have missed saying that Barb Armacost teaches at the University of Virginia School of Law. Dallas Willard teaches philosophy at USC. So we'll proceed with David.
Thank you, Bob. This, as he mentioned, the chapter, which I wrote with Randy Beck, who's a law professor at the University of Georgia, is on Genesis. And as the subtitle indicates, this chapter has several main themes. Creation, then the order of the world at the fall with God's preserving work, and then the stories of the patriarchs. And I want to use those three sort of three main moments in Genesis to order my remarks about what Genesis might tell us about the civil law, what sorts of things it gives us to think about. So I want to reflect first with you on creation, the first couple of chapters in the book of Genesis. Now, certainly, if we're thinking about that, the presentation of Genesis 1 and 2, a world without sin, a world before the fall, certainly we can't think about law as we know it now in that world. The civil law as we know it, but we can't conceive of it apart from sin. But there are some very important theological and anthropological themes that we find in Genesis 1 and 2 that do provide a lot of food for reflection and a lot of foundational ideas for thinking about law in later biblical contexts. The first person, the first character that we meet in Genesis is, of course, God. And one of the things that we discuss in our chapter is the fact that God is presented in Genesis 1 as one who is both a legislator and a judge. God has these legal functions. Now, you might wonder, what do I mean by God being a legislator in Genesis 1? Well, if you think about how God is described in Genesis 1, he is the one who orders all things. He brings things into being, makes distinctions among things. He gives things their names. He gives commands to various parts of creation to do certain sorts of work. And finally, in the creation of human beings at the end of Genesis 1, God gives this great commission, this creation mandate, in which he gives the law to his human creations. Now, God also has a judicial function in Genesis 1. If you remember how the account goes there, six times through that first story, God looks at what he's made and he says, "It is good." And then finally, at the end of the whole process, God looks at all he has made, and behold, it was very good. God enters into judgment upon his own work. And then, of course, in the story we find in Genesis 3, God enters into judgment upon his human beings who have fallen into sin. And so we see God described as a legislator and a judge. And if we think then about the end of Genesis 1, God is described as creating human beings according to his image and likeness. So here are these human beings made after God's image and likeness. And if God is presented as a legislator and a judge, if that's part of the relationship he bears to his creation, what does that say about human beings who are in his likeness? Well, if we think about the image of God, through a lot of Christian, the history of Christian theology, the image of God has been thought of in terms of attributes, right? The human beings have certain attributes like rationality and volitionality, and that this defines what the image of God is. Now, certainly the fact that we have reason and will is crucial for us being image bearers of God. But in the story of Genesis 1 itself, the image of God is a very active thing. It's not described in terms of certain attributes that human beings have. But human beings are described as receiving a commission. They are portrayed as God's rulers. They are those whom God has placed in this world to rule in his place. And we find human beings then having both a legislative and judicial kind of function. Human beings are commissioned to have dominion in this world. They are commissioned to subdue this world. The implication is that there is some things that God has left not entirely ordered, and that human beings are to take over that work under his authority and to have that ordering function. Human beings are also called to name the animals. Again, taking over this ordering function from God. The whole question of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in Genesis 2 and 3 is it's difficult to know what exactly that means. But through a lot of the rest of the Old Testament, knowing good and evil is a judicial act. It is something that kings do when they're serving in a judicial capacity. It seems likely, therefore, that what at least part of what Genesis 2 is getting at is that Adam there is given this test as to whether or not he will make the right kind of judgment, whether he will make the right kind of judgment about good and evil. Okay, so we know that the first human beings did not pass that test. There's a fall into sin. God puts a curse upon this world. But God doesn't bring this world into final judgment. God preserves this world. And the story proceeds beginning in Genesis 4 about this world. And there's this sort of mini history of the world that takes place through Genesis 4 and 5. And then the story of the flood comes in Genesis 6 and 7. And then following the flood, in the account beginning at the end of chapter 8, and then through the first part of Genesis 9, there is this account of the covenant that God makes with Noah, and through Noah with the whole human race. And this covenant is describes God's ordering of this world after the flood. And so now that we live in this post-fall world, we don't look to go back to Genesis 1 as if that is the world in which we live. But this covenant with Noah describes the way that God orders the world now, this fallen world. And in that covenant, we see that this legal or judicial function is to play a crucial role in man's life in this world. In Genesis 9:6, God says, "He who sheds the blood of man, by man shall his blood be shed, for God made man in his image." Now, one question that comes up is, why is there this appeal to the image of God there? It's often assumed that this explains why there is to be punishment, and serious, severe punishment for murder. Man was created in God's image. That is certainly part of the picture. There is this inherent human dignity that is violated with murder. But if you think back to Genesis 1, the image of God is an active concept. It is about exercising dominion in this world. So it seems to me likely that actually in Genesis 9:6, the primary purpose of that appeal to the image of God is not to explain why murder is so bad, but to explain why human beings receive this commission, this amazing commission, to actually take the judicial reins, as it were, and to execute the punishment for crime. Some implications that I think we can see from this covenant with Noah in Genesis 8 and 9. One, the portrayal here is that human legal systems are ultimately under God's authority. It is that God, in making this covenant with the fallen world, ordains the presence of a judicial system. A second thing that we can see is that enforcing justice, upholding justice, is one of the key functions of human beings in this fallen world. There are only a couple of commands that are given in Genesis 9 in this covenant. This idea of enforcing justice is one of them. Another thing that we see here is that the legal task is a universal human task. This covenant is made not with a special people that God sets apart from the whole human race. This covenant is made with all human beings. The task, this commission to do justice, is something that we who are Christians share with all other people. And that is certainly, so I think we have here theological, biblical grounding for understanding law as a universal human task. Another thing that we see, there are some others, but I only have time to mention one more, is that I think it's important to see here that the legal task is one for this age and not for the age to come. That the covenant with Noah doesn't promise salvation. It doesn't promise redemption. It talks about the preservation of this world. And it is in the context of the preservation of this present order that God commissions human beings to enforce justice. Finally, and I only have a very short time, but we spend a fair bit of our chapter reflecting on the story of the patriarchs, which really, beginning in Genesis 12 all the way through the end of the chapter, it takes up the bulk of the space in Genesis. One of the things that we see is that God sets apart a special people. God calls Abraham out of the midst of this larger human race. We've seen in earlier chapters of Genesis, say Genesis 4, that the human race as a whole, particularly the line of Cain, the unbelieving line of Cain, built cities. But here we see Abraham and his descendants sojourning in cities that they didn't build. Well, when we go to the New Testament, we find, say, in 1 Peter, that Christians are referred to as sojourners. In some very important respects, we are like Abraham and the patriarchs. We are those who are called to live in a multitude of cities in this world. We're not given a country or a city of our own as Christians. And so there is certainly much that we can learn, or at least things that we can reflect upon in the story of the of Abraham and the sojourners. I'm going to take the liberty to take about one more minute or so. And I know, what's he going to do?
Just turn your mic off.
Oh, no, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Just
like
a couple
the
of things.
Will start doing music.
Just a couple of things that we might learn, at least the things that we might reflect upon in light of the story of the patriarchs. One is that human justice varies from place to place, and that may affect the way that we who are believers are going to interact with the legal systems in which we find ourselves. Abraham and his descendants acted differently when they were interacting with Sodom or when they were interacting with the city of Gerar in Genesis 20. In that story in Genesis 20, Abraham and this pagan king Abimelech have a conflict. And one of the things that we see there as well is that Abimelech, the pagan king, has a greater sense of justice than Abraham does, at least in that particular story. And I think another thing that we can reflect upon here is that a certain sense of humility for those of us who are religious believers. Sometimes those that we might conceive of as those who are different, as those who stand outside of our faith, have greater insights into the ways of justice than we have. And finally, I would also suggest that these narratives in Genesis suggest that there is some sort of universally knowable moral law that exists. We see the pagan king Abimelech, for example, appealing to things that ought not to be done, presuming that there is this knowledge, that there are some things that people, no matter what religion, no matter where they come from, that they hold in common and that they ought to be able to expect from one another.
My section concerns the Mosaic Law, so Exodus through Deuteronomy, which I worked on along with David Skeel from Penn Law School. David isn't able to be here. I'm an Old Testament professor, so I thought the best use of my 10 minutes would be to talk about some of the hermeneutical moves we need to make in order to arrive to the point where David can reflect on its implications for contemporary law. Not being a law professor or a lawyer, I'll speak in the area of my expertise. But as opposed to a number of the other parts of the Bible, we got plenty of law, all right, in the Torah. And of course, famously, it begins in the book of Exodus with the giving of the Ten Commandments, followed by case laws, and all, and that's the first hermeneutical move we have to consider is what's the relationship between the Ten Commandments and the case law. At least that's what we call those laws in my field. I've heard a lawyer refer to them as statutory laws. But the first point, though, is that law is in a covenantal context in Exodus and throughout. That is, law flows out of the grace of God's redemption in from the Exodus in Egypt. The preamble to the Ten Commandments begins by reminding them of the grace that he showed before he goes into the Ten Commandments. Now, the relationship between the case law and the Ten Commandments, I think, is best described in this way, that the case laws are applications of the principles of the Ten Commandments to the specific sociological and redemptive historical context of the people of God at the time. So, for instance, take a law in Deuteronomy. It just illustrates my point the best. It says you must build a fence around your roof. Okay? What is that law all about? It is an application of you must not murder to Israelite architecture. Or, you know, the famous Goring Ox Law, which is famous particularly because it has a prehistory to the Bible. It's known there's a Goring Ox Law in the Code of Lipit-Ishtar, the Code of Ishnuna at the end of the third millennium, in the Code of Hammurabi at the beginning of the second millennium. And of course, if you date the Ten Commandments as early as Moses, you're talking about the 15th or 13th century BC. So the Goring Ox Law shows an interesting legal tradition, which was studied by J.J. Finkelstein about 40 years ago. But in any case, you have the Goring Ox Law. That's the application, again, of you must not murder in the case of your animal goring somebody. What happens there? And I understand we have something like this on some of our law books. One lawyer told me it's called something like the law of the second bite or something. If the ox gores somebody the first time, you must kill the ox, but if you don't and he gores somebody a second time, the owner is fully liable for, you know, the animal's actions. So that's the relationship between the Ten Commandments and the case law. Now, for those of us who are Christians, we want to ask the question, what is our relationship to the law from the perspective of the New Testament? And again, Jesus famously in Matthew 5:17 and following says, not a jot or tittle of the law will pass away until it's fulfilled. And as you study the New Testament, you see that some of the law is fulfilled in such a way that we don't observe it anymore. Things like the laws of sacrifice or the laws of, you know, the food laws, the kosher laws. Again, I'm speaking from a Christian context. The food law's function was to differentiate Gentiles from Israelites, and once that distinction falls down, they're no longer applicable. Here I do find that age-old division between ceremonial law, civil law, and moral law helpful, even though, as many people will point out, and I will agree, this is not a distinction any Israelite would ever have recognized. But that doesn't completely undermine the utility of such a distinction, especially as you talk about what laws continue to be relevant for us today. Ceremonial law are those laws connected with ritual, which I was just talking about, that are no longer observed because they've been fulfilled. Civil law is an interesting one to reflect on, and it reminds us of a very important fact as we think about how the law of the Old Testament may relate to both church and society today, because, you know, in the Old Testament time period, the people of God were a nation state, and the law's function was partly to keep that nation state pure. And so famously, you know, there are an awful lot of laws that have the death penalty connected with it. I would argue, based on a passage in Numbers 35, that the death penalty is a maximum, not a mandatory penalty in the case law, because Numbers 35 insists that in the case of premeditated murder, a conviction based on two witnesses mandates the death penalty. You cannot accept a lesser penalty, which seems to imply that you can accept a lesser penalty in regard to other crimes. And there are other supporting evidence for that as well. The civil law, including many of the penalties that are presented in the Old Testament, in one sense are not necessarily, shall we say, applicable. And of course, here you can see me distancing myself from an old view that still is around in some forms, but isn't as vital as it used to be, called theonomy. And I'm trying to chart, for those of you who are familiar with this kind of theological language, I'm charting a course between theonomy and dispensationalism when we're talking about the continuity and discontinuity between the Old and New Testaments. So that means, and as you look at the New Testament, you see that the New Testament continues to speak as if what I'm referring to as the moral law is still authoritative, still valid. It's interesting. Maybe I'll just close since, you know, 10 minutes I'm just laying out, I hope, some teasers. Is that what's interesting, I was on a panel at the Society of Biblical Literature on sexuality at, so it was a pretty broad panel. I was on with the editor of the Queer Study Bible and a couple of feminist scholars, my colleague on the panel was arguing that, you know, we don't pay any attention to food laws in the New Testament, so why do we pay any attention to the sexual laws? And my response to that was, it is interesting, you got to study these things sort of by topic, that the food laws are loosened, broadened, done away with. But actually, if you study the New Testament, the sexual laws get more narrowly defined. So divorce is more difficult in the New Testament than in the Old Testament. Polygamy seems to be discouraged and falling away. And, homosexuality, Romans 1 and other texts seem to reaffirm the teaching of the Old Testament. So there's a few comments and maybe 2 minutes extra for Barbara here.
Okay, so my topic this afternoon is justice and the prophets. And just to say really quickly, if you looked in my bio in the conference booklet, you probably thought, why is this person talking about the Bible or church and state? And so I just wanted to say that the church and state topic is one that is part of my teaching interest. And also, I have a degree from Regent College in Canada on religious studies. And so those two things have come together and ignited an interest in religious liberty sorts of issues. Now, the prophetic literature is often invoked by Christian scholars and reformers writing about issues of social justice and law. And for anyone familiar with the biblical prophets, this shouldn't be surprising. One of the most prominent themes of the prophetic literature is that true worship of God is manifested by doing justice and loving mercy. The prophets tell us that God hates injustice, that he hears the cries of the oppressed, and that he condemns the oppressors, and that he calls his people to act justly in their dealings with one another. My co-author Peter Enns is an Old Testament scholar, and our goal in writing this chapter is to avoid simply pulling passages out of the prophetic literature and applying them directly to modern issues without first taking seriously their original context. And this is something that both David and Tremper mentioned in their remarks. So, in other words, our goal is to apply a hermeneutical methodology that will distinguish what parts of the message are culturally embedded and what parts might speak with normative force beyond their own time. So framed this way, the project poses two distinct challenges with regard to American law. The first is raised by any resort to the Bible as a normative source. Many American citizens don't view the Bible as an authoritative source for their own moral decisions, let alone as a justification for political or legal decision making. The second challenge is that the prophets were written for ancient Israel, a context very different from our own. So I'll address the first challenge in only a very abbreviated form, as a full response would require an entire discussion. The challenge, of course, is from folks like political philosopher John Rawls, who argue that religious reasons are inappropriate as justifications for political discourse or political decision-making. So for purposes of this chapter, I want to say two things. One is that the Rawlsian notion of public reasons and also the precise reach of the political sphere in which those reasons are necessary are both contested. And more importantly, individuals at all levels of life do resort explicitly or implicitly to comprehensive views in formulating their judgments of what rules or values should govern in public life. And so to the extent that this is in fact true, I believe it's important to use these ancient texts responsibly and not as proof texts for predetermined policy goals. So that brings me to the second challenge, and the one that Peter and I address in this paper. The prophetic literature is not written with the American legal system in mind. It's written to address the nation of Israel, which I would call a theocratic monarchy. And its primary message is a theological message. The prophet's overarching goal is to call the people of Israel back to faithful adherence to their covenantal relationship with God, and to turn from idolatry and back to worship of and service to the true God. The prophetic books address ancient Israel during a period of its history when it was ruled by a series of kings. Now, quite obviously, our government is neither a monarchy nor a theocracy. And despite the theological roots of American exceptionalism, the United States is not in a covenantal relationship with God, at least in my view. Indeed, it's part and parcel of Christian theology that no one people enjoys favored nation status, neither Israel nor the United States. I think Jewish and Christian readers of the Bible would agree that the prophets must be read in their original context before any normative claims can be made about their applicability to modern law. Now, there's an additional complication for Christian readers. Christians believe that the prophetic writings came to a climax in the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. So in the book of Luke, the birth of Jesus is hailed as the inauguration of Israel's redemption. And more importantly, at the beginning of his earthly ministry, Jesus identified himself with the promise of Israel's restoration and declared his coming its fulfillment. So in his first recorded public speech, Jesus stood up in the temple and opened the scroll of the prophet Isaiah and read, quote, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recover of sight to the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Now, Jesus is quoting from Isaiah 61, 1 and 2, in which the prophet announces that salvation and restoration have come at last to the suffering people of Israel. In context, the messianic figure in Isaiah is pictured as a military royal figure who would fight for national existence. But at the end of the reading of this passage, Jesus rolled up the scroll, sat down, and declared, "Today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." With these words, Jesus claimed that he's the culmination of all the prophetic hopes and promises of a Davidic king who would restore Israel and rule the nation with justice and righteousness. So to summarize what I've said so far, let me just say four things. First of all, in his public speech in Luke 4, Jesus affirmed that the good news of the gospel includes God's promise to restore creation in all of its dimensions, including the promise to bring justice and healing. and rescue. Second, by quoting Isaiah 61, Jesus affirmed the prophetic message, that the prophetic message is in fact authoritative for the new Israel, for the new people of Israel. Third and relatedly, the message is not directed toward any particular nation as a nation, but it is directed toward God's redeemed people, some of whom function in places of power in various sectors of life. Fourth, those who embrace the gospel of Jesus ought to pursue, in both their public and their private lives, the things that God says he hates, and reject the things God said, and ought to embrace the things that God says he loves, and reject the things God says he hates. For this purpose, the prophets are actually a very rich source. God hates injustice. He hates abuse of power, cheating, bribery, and corruption, to name just a few. He loves justice, procedural fairness, honest dealings, and protection for the vulnerable and powerless among us. These are also demonstrated by Jesus' public ministry, in which he went about doing some of these things. Now, I want to suggest four implications for our legal system of reading the prophets this way. And there's much more that I could say in between, let me just say these four things so that at least you go away with some legal implications. So first of all, the prophetic message is targeted primarily at the level of institutions and leaders rather than individual community members. One of the most important audiences for the prophets were the kings and other high officials such as judges and administrators. Correspondingly, the substance of the prophetic message was largely institutional and structural. The prophets were concerned about such issues as fair taxation, equitable distribution of land, justice in the courts, and forbidding the taking of bribes. When they urge their readers to defend widows and orphans, they're not talking primarily about individuals caring for their neighbors, but communities as a collective acting justly toward their most vulnerable members. And in particular, they're talking about officials like judges and advocates and institutions like courts, precisely the roles and institutions for which lawyers are responsible. Moreover, the admonitions about what constitutes a just community are rooted not only in the covenant, but in the holiness of God himself. Thus, while America is not a monarchy and our legal system is not theocratic, the prophets give us important clues about how God will evaluate our communities, courts, and institutions. Second, and more basically, an intact legal system with just laws and officials who fairly enforce them is absolutely essential if we're going to have any hope of a just society of the sort described by the prophets. While an adequate legal system need not adhere to a distinctly Western model, human flourishing requires courts that fairly adjudicate crimes and disputes, laws that protect access to basic goods, officials that cannot abuse their power with impunity against the weak, judges that do not take bribes, and laws that apply equally to all. The admonitions of the prophets tell us something about the goals to which our legal system should aspire, goals the prophets call justice and righteousness, and they underline the essential role of law and legal institutions in securing these goals. Thirdly, the content of the prophetic call for social justice is uniquely, I think, a call to lawyers. Much of what lawyers do in the ordinary course determines how the weak and vulnerable actually fare in our society. The plight of the prisoner, for example, is largely determined by the criminal justice system, including just laws, skilled and honest advocates, and functioning courts to hear the cases. The care of the widow and the orphan depends significantly on what laws are in place to protect their rights. Laws like family law, tort law, benefit and employment law. And again, on the availability of lawyers and courts to enforce these rights. The alien, too, is beholden to justice, to the justice or not, of laws and legal procedures that determine his security and fate. This is all no small point. If the prophets call God's people to do justice, and if worship is detestable without justice, and if lawyers are responsible in large measure for ensuring justice in our community, then the prophetic message has a lot to say to lawyers and has important implications for judging our legal institutions. Finally, there's a sense in which lawyers are, so to speak, secular prophets. Now, I don't mean by this to elevate lawyers to some quasi-religious status. Rather, it is to observe that most legal arguments are designed to push the boundaries and change the status quo, which is a description that fits well with the biblical prophets. As American lawyers, we're very much committed to the notion that truth and justice is served if lawyers on both sides of an issue advocate rigorously for their clients and let the judge sort it out. For better or worse, lawyers are often in the role of seeking out plaintiffs who've been injured and digging around circumstances where fraud or injustice might actually be hidden. Much of the legal role, this legal role, involves bringing such stories to light, and this work, at least sometimes, results in protection and restoration of the most vulnerable among us. The prophetic literature might have something to say about better or less good vocational choices for those who wish to heed the prophetic message. Now, I want to end by saying that the assumption that the prophetic literature can be applied directly to our current situation, an assumption that I rejected, has led to some erroneous and, I believe, destructive readings. I reject a reading of the prophets as providing a religious basis for American exceptionalism, the idea that God has granted America a unique role in human history that is akin to the nation of Israel. It has become popular among religious conservatives to quote prophetic language as if its promises and curses apply directly to modern nations. So one example is conservative pastors who cite the prophetic message from 2 Chronicles 7 as a promise for America. As one website committed to this idea frames it, quote, "This is our country's national day of prayer. I believe God would say to us today, if the people of America who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and heal their land." Similar assumptions have led conservative Christians to claim that particular events, perhaps, for example, 9/11, are direct divine judgments for America's sins. And similar arguments have been made with regard to catastrophic events in other countries. There's no question that it's a huge privilege and responsibility to live in a country in which we have the freedom to participate in public life, including making religious arguments in the public square and doing public acts for religious reasons. But I do not believe the prophets can be read directly as promising blessings or curses on modern nations for particular behavior. Now, that's not the same thing as saying that conduct and beliefs have consequences. And if God is God, one would imagine that following the things he loves and rejecting the things he hates would actually produce good consequences. While the call to social justice requires just dealing and just institutions, I don't think it tells us precisely which institutions should do what, or even precisely what those institutions will look like. For example, while it seems clear, at least for the purposes of American liberal democracy, that certain institutions like courts and police departments should be governmentally run, it's not clear that the government should be the only or primary institution that cares for the poor, for example. In other systems of government, even courts could be more informal, and decentralized, and policing could perhaps be done by private citizens. In other words, I don't think that prophetic literature dictates that our government must have a particular kind of welfare system or that a just system cannot rely on market solutions. What it does say is that God will be pleased with our institutions to the extent that they are governed by justice, and he will be displeased to the extent that we fail to care for the most vulnerable citizens among us. Thank you.
Talking about Jesus and law is a very challenging subject and has lots of misunderstandings attached to it. Let me just start by saying something about law, period. Law has to do with regularities that have some necessity attached to them. And when you understand that, then you see there are different kinds of laws, and in particular, there is physical law. And that is a kind of law that takes care of itself. No one has to go around penalizing people for not falling when they step off of a roof. That takes care of itself. Secondly, there is something that we might call moral law. And moral law is kind of ambiguous about this. Does it take care of itself? Well, not obviously in every case. Now, you can take a position on that, that you may hear sometimes, that moral law actually does take care of itself. And if it isn't obvious that if you steal something, you pay for it, it will come back to bite you. And the idea that there is a kind of enforcement usually attributed to God or some larger order. And then thirdly, there is what we might call civic law. And that's also called human law sometimes by people like Augustine and Aquinas. And the important thing to understand about civic law is that it requires human enactment. There is no civic law without human enactment. And then it requires interpretation, it requires application and enforcement. And that is largely left in the hands of human beings. So law means a number of different things, and here we're going to stick mainly to civic law in our discussion of Jesus. But you can't limit it to that, because in his view, moral law is the foundation of civic law. It is not the foundation in the sense that you can derive a particular arrangement of civic order from the moral teachings. There's room for variations of various kinds. But on the view of Jesus, law as a civic order is a good thing, and it has to be supported by a context of some sort, a larger background. And that actually is given in his response to the question from the lawyer in Mark 12, what is the great commandment? And this great commandment sets the background for everything else that is dealt with in the law. It's very important, I think, to understand that Jesus is not opposed to law. And it is very common, especially in many Christian contexts, to suppose that the law has been set aside and replaced by something else, call it grace or faith or something of that kind. A very important statement in John 1:17 says, "Grace, the law came by Moses. Grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." That isn't a kind of opposition where you have to choose one or the other. Actually, it's a case of supplementation. The law of Moses will not work without grace and truth that comes from living in God's kingdom. And so you're looking at supplemental relationship, not a relation of opposition. And that is why Jesus says that he came to fulfill the law and not abolish it. That statement by his in Matthew 5 is said in a context where what he had previously said would naturally have led the hearers to think he was going to abolish the law, because he precisely announced the blessings of the kingdom of God upon people who, according to the law, as that was understood by its interpreters at the time, could not be blessed. When you say things like, "Blessed are the poor," or even, "Blessed are the poor in spirit," it's a little slightly a different dimension, that does not fit in with prevailing ideas of who is well off. Even today, if you were to suggest that someone who was poor was blessed, you might get some cognitive dissonance up with that idea. Jesus announces the blessing of God upon people as understood at the time, upon people who could not be blessed. And now, having done that, he says, "Think not." Now, when do you say "think not" to people? You say "think not" when they're thinking, right? And he recognized that people were sitting there saying, "Well, this sounds like the law is being abolished." They were thinking of the law as they experienced it as a social reality. And so he says, "Don't think that. I am come to fulfill it." Now, I want to say that I believe what he was saying was, "I am come not only myself, but to lead others to live a life in which what the law of God declares is actually done. And the Ten Commandments, or some other formulation of that, would be important to think of in that connection. Imagine a world in which people actually don't steal. Now, most of us have locks on our doors, and that is an attempt to replace the moral vacuum in human life with a physical vacuum. The lock is supposed to control the situation without consulting with anyone. It's a physical law. And we do a lot of that in our lives. Just think of the security industry as we have it. So Jesus comes to bring a life in which people actually do what the law says. That's grace and truth. And grace and truth is living in the kingdom of God from resources that actually enable you to do what the law of God says. Now, one of the major things that he does is to try to correct the abuses of the law in human hands. One paragraph in the chapter that Bob and I worked on, it says, Jesus's most noticeable response to law in his culture was to challenge it as a distorted expression of God's moral law and of life in the kingdom of God. His was a legalistic culture where human law had forgotten its purpose, where human law served itself and its experts rather than people. And you will, I think, be familiar with the passages like Matthew 23, where if he ever gave anyone a scalding treatment, he dishes out some of the strongest rebukes imaginable to the people who were misusing the law for their own advantage. And so there are a number of dimensions of that. For example, the overextension of the law for righteousness. The trivial things about Sabbath keeping, about washing, about how far you could walk on a Sabbath, and so on. And also the deeper problem with neglecting mercy and humility, and counting the seeds of your garden to tithe one-tenth of them, and neglecting mercy and judgment. And then finally, the use of the law for domination. And he has a statement where he says, do what the lawyers say, but don't do what they do, because they tie intolerable burdens on the backs of people and do not move a finger to lift them. So that idea of the abuse of the law is a major point of what Jesus does. But he doesn't thereby set the law aside. The law is a good thing. It's a necessary thing. We have to have it. And he understands that the law should be an expression of love. And so the theme from Micah 6:8, what does the Lord your God require of you? Do justice, love mercy. But people were into justice without mercy. And that's something that he comments on. Very famous passage in Matthew 9:13, 12:7 again, where he says, if you had understood that I require justice, mercy, and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. And this idea that comes out of the prophets is a major part of what Jesus is working with in the background of life in the kingdom of God. And that's the main thing that Jesus brings, is the understanding of the context of law, that law does not run on its own. He understood that justice alone will never do justice to justice. If that's all you have, you will never get what you hope for out of justice. You get something, maybe, and it's good, but you will never get what you had hoped for in the way of a life in a just society with just people. So the great command that I referred to earlier, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord, and you shall love him with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength, and your neighbor as yourself. See, that's the liberty of living in the kingdom of God, under God, that allows people to then deal with particular issues in moral and in civic law from an appropriate basis. So we have the responsibility to act in terms of civil enactments, many of which covered religious matters in Jesus' own day. We have that responsibility, but we have to be careful with it. And one of the things that Bob brought into our chapter that I thought was so good was the case of the woman taken in adultery, as they say. Now, you don't have to use your imagination a lot to figure out this was really a bad situation. I mean, for one thing, it's hard to catch a woman in adultery without catching a man in adultery. Where was the man? And so this was a set-up deal that was wrong from the start, and Jesus approaches it in a very thoughtful way within the law and finds a way to bring conviction on the lives of the people who were prepared to stone this woman to death by locating mercy and putting it into practice for her deliverance. So I think we have the universal task of human beings of finding laws that depend upon human enactment and then interpreting them, applying them, and enforcing them. But when we think about that in the light of the great commandment to love God and our neighbor as ourselves, and see that as learning a way of living that then deals with the problems that we have in law, we discover the righteousness of God apart from the law, to use Paul's phrase in Romans 3:17. There is a righteousness of God apart from the law. And that's where we learn to live as disciples of Jesus Christ. Now, there's so much more that needs to be said. Again, law is a good thing. Law prevails in the spiritual life. If you don't understand how to lead the spiritual life in terms of the laws that govern it, it'll never work. So there's a lot more to be said, but maybe we'll find room for that as well.
Well, we've got some time for discussion, provocative papers. We've actually each heard these presentations before, and of course these were things we'd already written. Now's the time when we get to learn from your questions.
This is for Barbara.
I
appreciated the careful dissertation on Genesis 3, and this is relevant to the nation of Israel and America today, but what about the proper analogy between Israel and the church? And would that suggest maybe a couple of questions? First of all, who are the prophets to the church today? What's their role? And then second, might the church's role with respect to the law be one of witness? So I'm thinking of David Steele, for example, saying, you know, for debt relief, this is a way to model to U.S. laws what it could look like. For Lisa Schultz, this is a way that we can model caring for people with disabilities to the Americans with Disabilities Act. And so is there if the analogy today to the church, is there a way in which there is a prophetic voice to the church, and then the church, in response to that prophetic voice, witnesses to the laws?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, what I was trying to say when I said that our legal institutions, I think the important sort of background idea is to understand what God loves and what God hates. And so to the extent that our legal and governmental systems are structured and framed in a way that promotes the things God loves and that resists the things God hates, that we're doing what would be pleasing to him. And so you asked whether the church could have a prophetic voice. that's your question, right? On some of these things to the outside. So you ask, so let me understand your question. So you said, who's speaking to the church prophetically? And then should the church have a prophetic voice into the? Is that captured
yeah, that
right?
Yeah, or witnessing something. Not, it doesn't. I don't know if it has to be prophetic.
Yeah.
But
so I take it that there's. Let me answer it this way. I would disagree with those who say that the job of the church is just to preach salvation. That is, it seems to me that the church needs to be equipping its people and speaking through its people into the culture about what makes a just system. And so I think the church ought to have a prophetic voice, yes. And that the prophetic voice should... And one of the things I really care about in reading the prophets is... Do the prophets tell us anything about what the church ought to be saying? And I think they do. So, yes, I believe the church ought to have a prophetic voice into the sort of polity. Who's speaking prophetically to the church? I guess the word itself is speaking prophetically to the church, right? In other words, I think... Maybe I'm not answering your question, but I think the Old Testament prophets, as they're brought into the New Testament context, have something to say to the church and have something to say to the content that should... the content of the church's prophetic voice into the culture.
Let me just ask a follow-up question of Barb. You've made the point that the church should speak prophetically to the culture, right, rather than just focusing on salvation.
Yes.
What then is the place of salvation? Does it take a secondary role, or is there a balance to be struck? Is there a priority between them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Jesus's main challenge was to preach the good news. And I actually think the good news is, first and foremost, the good news of the opportunity to be saved from sin and brought into right relationship with God. So I think the preaching of the gospel is first and foremost about salvation. But I also think the good news is bigger than that, or at least, if you think about Jesus' promise in Luke 4 and also think about the book of Revelation, the restoration that Jesus promises is to individuals to be brought into right relationship with God, but it's also to bring all of creation back into right relationship. All of creation is groaning to be released. And that means bringing about health, restoration of just dealing, a world in which all things are restored. Right, security, some of the things that Dallas talked about. So I think there's a sense in which, you can divide sort of the message about salvation and the message about restoration. You can divide those two, or you can just realize that the message of restoration is big. I think some people would say, for example, if you ask the question, why does the International Justice Mission go out and try to rescue people? If the International Justice Mission isn't preaching gospel, then what's the point, right? Because right, and I just don't think that that's the right way to think about it. So that it seems to me that that we ought to care about the things Jesus cared about, and we ought to care about them now. So the International Justice Mission goes into a brothel, and it bursts into a brothel, and there's a child that's been raped, and she's lying there on the floor. What the International Justice Mission lawyer is really saying to that person is, Jesus sent me to get you out. Right? So part of the testimony that we give to the world is that we're trying to do things the way God would have us do, that we're trying to function in a way that we're doing what Jesus would do. Is right relationship with God the most important thing? Yes. Is it a wonderful gift? Yes. But I also think we need to be participating in with Jesus in the kinds of restoration that he was doing.
Okay, and in anywhere along the line, if any of the other panelists want to jump in on some of these questions, go ahead and do so. Question.
So my question is actually for Dallas. And a lot of the discussion kicked from the state, but the religion clauses are not to kick the exercise of religion out of the public domain. And now in a context where there's so much diversity in our society and there's some difficulty in moving from a context where we would protect religious free exercise, where there's such diversity of potential ranges of religious expression. But it seems to me that from your talk, the major problem of the Christian church remains the same today as it was even in the 18th century, which is how do we create space for the life of the kingdom of God to create life-giving conduct within the members of the American population. So that seems to me not to have really changed at all, but the problem is how do we encourage a spiritual life through our official organs of government in a context where the encroachment of the state into religious life is nearing a point of entirely excluding any public discussion of religion in official ways. So how can we do that in any meaningful way when the Constitution is increasingly being interpreted against any kind of public support of religion in life?
Well, those are huge issues and good issues, and we're eventually somehow going to have to come to grips with this. What I would say is that the main way that we do this is by forming people in our religious communities to go into government service, to serve as lawyers, and in all of the instrumentalities of the government. Because this drift that you're talking about has happened simply because of the individuals who are there. And what we've seen is an incredible shift of just even the meaning of the terms that are used in things like the First Amendment and so on. So that many people no longer know that it's about not interfering. It's not a matter of controlling the function of religion in government and out. What lies back of all of this is the idea that the religious person does not speak from knowledge. They speak from tradition, prejudice, and so on. The non-religious person speaks from knowledge. They're not prejudiced. They're not bound by tradition. But of course, what we have now established in this country is a secular tradition. And it will take the individual and frame what they would and would not say in their context. So I think that this is a tremendously important thing, and we have to recognize, for example, that every day, every week, or every day in our churches, we are addressing the public square. That's the people who are there. And what we need to do is to help them learn how to live as Christians wherever they are. And that would include education and dealing with these, I mean, the sort of the linchpin of this whole idea is that you distinguish between faith and knowledge. And you say that religion does not provide faith. The Bible does not, it only provides faith. There's no knowledge that comes out of the Bible, because it's a religious book. And now that's a part of the framework of our educational system. And the only hope is that the church or institutions like Pepperdine will become serious about those things and set them right.
Bob. This is also a question for Adele. So Bob, since you're co-author, you might have something to say. I was really struck by your statement, justice alone will never do justice to justice. Right. And I know you were talking about the righteousness apart from the law.
Right.
But what does that statement mean for human law? Do we could look at it as saying, well, justice alone will never do justice to justice, but it might be the best we can hope for from human law. Or we can say, justice alone will never do justice to justice. So even with human law, there is a vital role for grace and truth, mm-hmm. even if it's just a rough facsimile of the real thing mm-hmm. when we're talking about human law. So is there a role for grace and truth in human law because of the limits of justice alone? And if so, what is?
I certainly hope there is, because if there isn't, we're in much more worse trouble than we have ever thought of. And so even all the religious considerations aside, just normal human interactions around the law will have to find some areas for grace and truth. And actually, I think that that traditionally has been a part of the role of the judge. And they are called judges because they make judgments. That means they don't just follow rules. And at that area, you will see in many cases judges who are guided by grace and truth. Now, that can get them in trouble, but, you know, trouble is the human condition. So I really think we have to look for grace and truth, and that I'm convinced that we are in a society of incredible anger because we have tried to get justice alone. And you don't have to love your neighbors yourself, just hate them all equally.
David, this is for you. You didn't talk very much about Cain and Abel and Lamech. And I know that in Augustine's reading of Genesis and his origins of the two cities, Cain and Lamech play a really important role, and it's a role that brings a sort of bigger question about the justice that's possible in the city that it sounds like it might be focused on the Noahide at the beginning of that story. So do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, and we do talk about this a little bit in our chapter. It's part of just the time constraints, which I didn't follow very well as it was. When you look at Genesis 9, you know, there is the sense of, okay, why is human justice portrayed in this terse formula, he who sheds the blood of man by man will his blood be shed? And I think in part it's to address the particular problem that sort of triggered the flood at the beginning of Genesis. There's this great violence on the earth. You know, there's this bloodshed which has put this curse upon the ground. So God, you know, after the flood, he gives the exact same verdict that he gives in Genesis 6. In Genesis 6 is, you know, all the thoughts of the heart of man are always evil all the time, something like that. And he says basically the same thing in Genesis 8 after the flood. In Genesis 6, he says it, and then he says, I'm going to wipe the earth. You know, I'm going to wipe out the earth. Genesis 8, he makes the same verdict. And he says, I'm not going to put a curse on this world again. And so, I think in this covenant with Noah, we do see this, in a sense, this common grace of God to put this kind of a restraint upon the full outbreaking of violence that is portrayed in this very, obviously, this very stark, concise terms in Genesis 4 especially. But I think there definitely is that theme of that violence which lies at the heart in the sinful human heart, and that's the very reason why there has to be this covenant after the flood. And this, you know, just to sort of follow up a little bit on the last question and Dallas's answer, I think the covenant with Noah does provide some answer to the question about, you know, is there something more than just justice? Because I think in this covenant with Noah, you see God, there's still a manifestation of God's justice. He says, I'm going to call to account those who shed the blood of man. But at the same time, there is this restraint, there's this forbearance on God's part. It's not going to bring another flood to destroy this world. And so that's not the full manifestation of God's redemptive grace. It's sort of eschatological grace. But there is this kind of this mercy and forbearance that we see that I think takes us beyond mere justice. And I think that's necessary, in a sense, if justice was the only response to the sinfulness of the human heart, there would be no human society to continue.
I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it off there. I've got a few announcements that I need to make. Those of you that are getting CLE credit, see Katie, the next to last row on the end. Secondly, there's a book table out front in the atrium where the books of a number of our speakers for this weekend are available. You might want to stop by there. It'll be open only until 5 today. Tomorrow, the books will still be available, but they'll be available inside the bookstore, which is just to the left off of the atrium. And then finally, those of you who are interested in Catholic Mass, we actually have a priest with us this weekend who's going to celebrate Mass at 5 o'clock today in room SR2, which is just around the corner down this hall. So those of you that might be interested in that, you're welcome. And with that, why don't you join me in thanking our panel.